Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
This is the Andy Griffin Show on this Wednesday, the 4th day of December, 2024. Good morning, everybody. I'm Andy. It's about 9 minutes after 9 o'clock. Dr. David Blodgett is with me today, the Johns Hopkins trained super stud doctor guy. Something like that. How are you doing, Doc?
I'm good. Thank you. Yeah, good to after have that you introduction, I better.
I know. You've got to be a super stud. I don't think that's actually an official designation. I just made that one up. But. Appreciate you beginning here. We were just talking a little bit about Thanksgiving, and you know, you have a good Thanksgiving. Did you fall victim to what some of us do on Thanksgiving? A little overeating, maybe eating more than you should, or more different things that you would normally not eat.
It might just be impossible not to.
Yeah, right? So. You're right. Do you have a Thanksgiving? Is there a weakness food for you? Something that you're just like, oh, this is so good. I gotta have.
Pumpkin pie. Usually, it's the pumpkin pie.
At least pumpkin pie, especially if you don't eat a lot of the crust.
Yeah,
it's actually pretty good for you.
Yeah, it's better than some.
We started making something called pumpkin cake, and it's a layer of cake and then a layer of pumpkin filling, mm-hmm. and then a kind of a brown sugar glaze on top.
Oh,
and
then
you take a piece and you put it in the microwave for 30 seconds, and it's a little Cool Whip on top. And that was the first thing to go.
Sounds like we need to have the Andy recipe and cooking show.
You know, I made that years ago. I found a recipe for it and made it once, and everybody liked it so much that it's now a Griffin family tradition. We have to have it, or it's not Thanksgiving without it. So,
sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was good. Wanted to talk today a little bit. Maybe this ties into what we were just talking about a little bit, but the latest craze. Now, I actually went in to my doctor, what do they call them? Personal physician, personal family, whatever. And the PCP, the primary care physician. And I asked them about, you know, what's going on with all the weight loss drugs. How do you qualify? Will insurance help pay for them? Do they really work? How do they work? And, you know, he had some really interesting answers for me. But I felt like he didn't know the whole picture, and I thought, well, let's talk to Dr. Blodge a little bit. Maybe he can help shed the light on the weight loss drugs. And I mean, we've talked a little bit about it in the past on the show.
Yeah.
We've never really gone kind of deeper into it. And so I right up front, I'll tell you, I have a sister and a sister-in-law who have lost a lot of weight on two different of the weight loss drugs. One is on Mounjaro, I think, and the other one is on just a semi-glutide compound. And it's working for them.
Yeah.
You know, in my mind, it's anecdotal, but I see these drugs working very well.
So yeah, I mean, it's clear that it works for a lot of people. There's this strange wrinkle that I haven't quite figured out, and that is when you take it for weight loss, it seems to work for weight loss, but when you take it for diabetes, doesn't necessarily cause as much weight loss, and I haven't quite figured out why that would be.
That is weird. Yeah.
And I actually have seen studies that have kind of verified that. So it is in practice a diabetes medication, and it works really well for diabetes.
Now we're talking about the name brands: Ozempic, Zepbound, Wegovy, Mounjaro. All have semaglutide in them, right?
Yeah. Well, semaglutide is another name for Ozempic. They're all GLP-1 agonists. So or some combination of that. So like Mounjaro has GLP-1, it's a GLP-1 agonist, but also has other components to it. So they've added, there's several hormones in that same realm that your body produces that help suppress appetite, things like that. And so one of the reasons Mounjaro is kind of a standout in the field is that they've added an extra hormone component in there that makes it even more effective. So,
I actually talked with a guy, and I'm not going to tell you his name because people would recognize his name. It's someone who's local famous, I guess, who started on Mounjaro, and he said the weird thing for him, and he's only been on it a couple of weeks, but he said the weird thing is they told him it would reduce his cravings. He said, I thought that meant it would reduce my wanting a cookie between meals or my wanting a Snickers bar or whatever. He said, it's actually reduced my cravings to eat, period. Yeah. I have no desire to eat ever. He says, I eat because I know I'm supposed to eat is all I do now.
Yeah.
So,
well, and part of the reason for that is it, and really the reason is that it slows down your digestive tract. So you're not moving food through very quickly. Hmm. And that's the mechanism that makes you feel full, right? And so, so you're in kind of a state of perpetually feeling like you just ate. And
of course, if you just ate, you're not hungry.
Yeah. But, well, I guess we'll get into the side effect profile later, there are no silver bullets. There's no perfect solution.
Right.
But in this case, it does seem to be working for a lot of people. Well, but, can I put the butt on there?
Yes, please do. Yes.
There is a high percentage. So if you have like a 6 or 7% failure rate because of not tolerating the side effects, that's kind of a high risk.
Pretty
drug,
significant,
right?
Yeah.
In this case, it seems like that rate is like 30 or 40%. A high number of people just say, "I just can't deal with this," you know.
And the stop. Side effects would be upset stomach,
nausea, vomiting. Among the more dramatic I've heard is you because your digestive system is so slowed. You feel constipated all the time, and then when you actually do have a bowel movement, it's huge. filling the toilet kind of stuff, and so it can really be very distressing for people.
Yeah,
so.
And what did you say that the rate is then?
It's in the kind of 30 to 40% range, depending on the study, and so that's significant, right? That's a lot of people. Yeah. And most people that keep going on it, they say, it's miserable, but I'm willing to do it because, I'm seeing good results. So
let's go big picture before we get into some of the details. A lot of people believe, I've got a chart here. You can't see it, but I can see it. A lot of people believe that a lot of the big pharma, they call it, would rather you be diabetic, would rather you be obese because there's all kinds of drugs that they can sell you and make a lot of money on if you're obese, if you're big. So big pharma, I would think, it would be kind of anti any of these types of drugs. Is that true?
Well, I think in this situation, you've got big pharma wanting to make the money on this medication too, right?
Right, but can they make enough to make up for all the money that they're going to lose?
Well, they're certainly trying to. I mean, this is
that's true. It's expensive. Yeah,
and, I think any generalization is not helpful, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of people in any profession that really want to do good for people and help out and things like that, and It sure seems like sometimes some of those medicines that just maintain people in the state they're in, and you take the drug forever, but maybe that's the best they can do. I mean, I think it's more complicated than they always want to just make money. And,
well, I think on a personal note, I take restless leg drugs. I take a drug so that I can sleep at night. If I don't take it, my legs are so restless, I cannot fall asleep. It's just brutal. I would love for someone to say, here's the drug to fix restless legs forever. It's going to go away. Well, there isn't one of those. So I'm taking a drug every night to help me sleep, get through their, not to help me sleep. It's not a sleeping drug, but it's a drug to block. It's complicated. But anyway, make it so my legs aren't kicking, or at least so I can't detect the feeling that you get. So in that case, yeah, you're right. It would be great to have a drug that cured me.
Yeah.
But there isn't one.
Right.
So Big Pharma is making money off of me selling restless leg drugs to me, but I'm grateful for them, and I'm not going to go off of them because I can't sleep with them.
Yeah, and sometimes there just isn't a permanent solution.
Yeah,
and, So I think the overgeneralizations are always problematic. But
yeah, yeah. All right. So we get back to these drugs and this weight. It calls into question again the whole: is it worth it to take this drug now to avoid what we know? I mean, you and I talk about it all the time, obesity and high blood pressure and hypertension and heart disease, all these things that are going to come with being obese, never mind diabetes, which is a whole other deal. These drugs could help us avoid or stave off some of this stuff if we can afford them. By the way, you mentioned the price.
Yeah.
So then you get down to, is it worth it? Is it worth the money? Is it worth maybe the nausea or whatever to know that I might be extending my life or at least saving some money down the road?
Yeah, and then I think that's the balance we're trying to achieve.
Right.
There's an ethical component to this. If you have the money, you can get it. If you don't, you can't, kind of
definitely,
stuff.
And definitely.
I think ultimately the real drawback that's really hard to know what to do with is the fact that as soon as you go off of this, you bounce right back, right? And so there needs to be a significant behavioral component to this where you not only put people on the medication, but you teach them how to keep it off once it's off. And that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah.
And so, we want the easy way out. We want the medication, but the weight loss plateaus after about a year, and then most insurances aren't really willing to cover it past that, but then as soon as you go off, you bounce right back up, and sometimes you end up worse off than when you started, and so as you do that calculus in your mind, you got to figure, I'm losing weight because I'm not hungry anymore. What happens when I am hungry again?
Right.
I have mechanisms in place to help? Am I willing to put some exercise component into my day? Am I willing to, put more fruits and veggies, all that stuff we talk about? And unfortunately, it still comes back to the same old boring stuff,
it always does, doesn't it?
so this really can help give that kickstart to things, to see that benefit and that progression and all of that stuff. But if it's not coupled with some mechanism to keep it going, and even to go past that year, if you're going to go past that year, you need to add some sort of other component to that to really help it continue to do what you need it to do. And so I think that's one part of this that hasn't been very well addressed.
And the thing about it is your doctor, they're not necessarily at fault. They probably will tell these people, people that are on this, you need to incorporate the stuff we were just talking about, the exercise or whatever, into how you live. And as you've many times felt the frustration of the general populace going, whatever. And they don't do it. As far as the cost, so I told you, I asked my doctor about it, and he's like, well, the only way you can get insurance to cover it is if you are pre-diabetic, and this would help you stave off becoming type 2 diabetic, or if you have high blood pressure, hypertension, something like that. If you don't meet currently, now this could change over time, but he said currently, if you don't meet these requirements, insurance will not pay for it. It's coming out of your pocket. And so he had me do the fasting blood test and all that stuff, and I did not qualify for any of that. So I'm like, well, okay, if I want this stuff, guess what? I got to pony up the bucks. And as you mentioned, they're trying really hard to make sure they're getting paid, Big Pharma.
So far, I it'll be interesting as this hits generic status and stuff, and more competition enters, that's the genius of the American system is
true.
Is competition always helps to keep things where it should be. But As long as it's on patent, and you know, so like Ozempic was the first to the market, and that's one of the names that people know.
Right.
Wegovy, what? So, that's a big pill, right? $12,000-$15,000 a year to take this medication.
And by the way, for those that are wondering, we talked about this before, but these are delivered via shot. You have to give yourself or have someone give you a shot, which is a weird problem. Giving yourself a shot is kind of a weird thing and everything. But we did it for a while. I was low on B12, and I did B12 shots for a while. I had to give myself B12 shots. That was just a weird thing. Like, okay, get some alcohol swab and stab yourself. It was just strange. But anyway, it is delivered by shot. And the reason for that is, I think, right, correct me if I'm wrong, if you were to try to swallow a pill, the digestive system would actually destroy the usefulness of it.
Yeah, well, and so Ozempic actually has an oral form.
Oh, does it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, this is new.
You can take as a pill, yeah. And it seems to be almost as effective as the injections, not
really?
Quite, perhaps, but I think they've figured out there are ways you can coat things and wrap it in, you know, so that you can be absorbed and stuff like that. So I think that's what's happened here. It's a daily thing is the problem. It's not like the once a month injection, and so you run into a little bit of compliance issues with that as well.
Basically, you have to take a pill a day, is
right.
What you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So
I think most of the audience here is, at my age or older, is going, hey, I take pills every day anyway, so it's not
just
a big
just
deal.
Just load it on, right?
Yeah. So interesting. Now, what do you make of, and I was talking with my doctor about this, compounding pharmacies that, so he was telling me there's a compounding pharmacy in town that is not regulated, oversight maybe, and he will not send his patients to this one to get the compounding. But there's another one in Nevada that does have he said they have an oversight, they are approved, and he said, I will send him to this other one, because even though it's in Arizona and they have to have it, you have to have it mailed to you and everything, he said it's actually, at least there's some oversight.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, somebody cooking it up in there.
Yeah,
is not nearly what you want to see, right? You want to
right.
be in compliance with regulations and things like that, and so unfortunately, I think the enforcement mechanisms around a lot of this stuff are difficult because there's just so many places you have to be and look, so you have to take doppel the Department of Professional Licensing. I'm sure they would want to know about this, but it's hard to.
And keep it all
hard to keep it going, and I know there have been a lot of lawsuits by the companies that produce these products to try and suppress some of this kind of bootleg manufacture here. It's all still under patent and things like that, but and when they actually go in and they look at the if we want to call them unauthorized compounding agents, there are people that do this, the variation in quality is huge,
Wow.
So
okay.
How much is actually there?
So maybe
it's actually.
That's why my doctor said I won't send you to this one because I feel like that, like you said, the quality of it could be.
And they find contaminants in there. It's kind of the Wild West once you get outside the regulated environment.
Interesting,
but it is cheaper, right? So that's why people are willing to try it. So.
The thing that I was thinking about with all this now, the injection is. First of all, it's not very much, but it's very bizarre to think, and I know this is, I'm being naive here, it's very bizarre to think, that much liquid injected in you could actually have that much of a behavioral change.
Yeah, well, it's a hormone, right? And hormones are generally very small amounts to accomplish what they need to do. Your body's attuned to signals within itself and doesn't take tons to... what it needs to do.
I mean, if you think about it, if you take, my restless leg pill is very, very small too, mm-hmm. and yet I know it works for me.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't be surprised at that small amount, but I look at it and I go, how can that have a behavioral effect?
Yeah. You're talking 2.5 milligrams kind of range.
Really, so. A really small amount. So, I asked you this before, and so I'll ask it again. If you knew someone who was obese and was really struggling with their weight, would you recommend that they take one of these if they could afford it?
I think so. I mean, it's kind of the same question. Would you recommend bypass surgery? You know, if somebody was really suffering and headed down the wrong path. I think for the moment, the side effect profile, as far as we know, is not worse than taking the medication. I think it gives people a real hope and chance to do something they haven't been able to do in their lives. But I think the qualifier there is they got to understand this isn't the magic bullet without some significant input from them. You know, the effort is required. And if you think you can just be the same as you've always been and have this work long term for you, it just isn't that way. So
well hopefully those that have decided to do this will take that to heart, because I think a lot of people do look at it as a magic bullet of saying, you know what, I'm not going to do anything, I'm just going to take this pill and I'm going to lose weight and I'm not going to change, you know, my behavior whatsoever. I will add a little caveat to that, though. If you lose weight, you're more likely to do some of those more physical things.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, it doesn't hurt. So we actually had a conversation on here. A caller called in and said, well, what about, what, you know, loss of muscle happens with this?
Right.
So anytime you lose weight, you will lose muscle.
Sure.
It's just part of the problem, and part of the process. And part of it is you're just not carrying around as much weight, so you have less need for muscle to carry around that weight, if that makes sense. And it seems like from the studies that I've read and looked at, that the weight loss, the muscle loss is probably less than it would be if you just, you know, all of a sudden lost weight from like a bypass surgery or something like that. But I think that highlights again where the behavioral changes need to come in. You need to build muscle independent of that so that you don't lose muscle and have it cause problems, right? And so you end up muscle loss as you age is one of those things that contributes to falls and overall health. You know, it's part of what you need to maintain in order to keep healthy. And so loss of muscle capacity is something to worry about, which again is one of those lifestyle kinds of issues. And the more muscle you have, the better you are at processing sugars and all. I mean, it's all part of the same continuum. So,
but you would say, in your estimation, you're not losing more muscle than fat in these situations. It's equal.
It's a byproduct of what happens when you lose weight.
Right.
Regardless.
Okay. So we've got a couple of texts and we'll have the doctor answer them. Is there anything on the market other than these drugs that curbs your appetite? I'm not overweight, but I feel like I'm hungry all the time. We've read about so many different things. Oh, this will make you not hungry. This will curb your appetite. Besides these weight loss drugs we're talking about, are there other drugs that actually work to curb appetite?
This is where it's an N of one, right? I think everybody needs to kind of see what they can do. Because I think there's evidence that increasing your fiber intake will help, you know, because it does a lot of the same kinds of things. It'll kind of slow down the process a little bit, but it's a healthier, it's not a mandated slowdown. It's a process there. So, you know, including more bulky things in your diet seems to help. That's why fruits and vegetables seem to help in that arena. But as far as like a supplement or something like that that's really been shown long term to help, it doesn't really, there are no magic bullets there. It's just a matter of finding what it is that seems to work for you in your life. Exercise, believe it or not, and more sleep. You know, we're back to our sleep thing, tend to stabilize appetite. So if you're not sleeping, that creates, and you remember we've talked about artificial sweeteners in sodas and, you know, and stuff. So you create an expectation of sugar, with sweet things, but when they don't have sugar, that creates an appetite stimulation. And so there's this spectrum that you can look at. But
diet sodas make you hungry. That's I think what he's saying, right?
They do.
They do. Okay.
My favorite quote is from a researcher out of Yale, where he said, "It turns your sweet tooth into a sweet fang." So,
all right, I got to get a weather break in. I have another text I want to read to you, and then we'll also talk about maybe some of doctors' concerns as we finish up 2024 in public health, some of the things that we need to worry about. I know a lot of people have gotten weird about vaccines ever since the COVID vaccine seemed to be somewhat ineffective. And so Scott, I'm saying, well, I'm not going to take any vaccines. And we'll talk about that and more when we come back. Right now, let's check weather.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Welcome back. Our monthly visit with the good doctor, Dr. David Blodgett, here on the Andy Griffin Show. Thank you again, Dr. Blodgett, for being here. Appreciate
it. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You had to get up and drive from Cedar City to here. And now you have two offices, right? You have one here and one in Cedar?
Yes.
Do you have one in like Beaver and other places too?
Yeah, so we have five locations to better serve you.
Do they have like a room for you, an office for you in all those locations?
Yeah, there's a place I can go if I need to. But
imagine you live in your laptop a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot in the car, a lot of meetings on the road.
Mm. All right. Well, we're talking a little bit about weight loss and weight loss drugs today. Good text from, this is from Jan, said, help reduce overeating by drink water or water with lemon juice. Often we think we're hungry, but we're really just thirsty. Let's talk about thirst a little bit. You know the old adage, if your pee is really yellow, you're not getting enough, you're not drinking enough. If it's clear, you're drinking maybe too much. How much of that is true, and how much should we be drinking?
Yeah, you know, I think it's definitely good to drink probably more than we are, and being conscientious about drinking is a good thing. But, you know, the old eight glasses a day adage is probably not based on anything in reality. It was just some researcher used that in some study at some point. So
and we picked it up and it went viral and we all did it.
There's a lot of things like that, like 10,000 steps, you know, what is that based on, you know, all of it's kind of, anyway. But I don't know that you want to use urine color as your gauge. I think being conscientious about saying I'm going to, And it might be just about as much as, you know, what kinds of things are you drinking too, right? I mean, if you're drinking things that require a lot of processing to excrete them, that's not as helpful as like good old water, right?
Right.
And so the kidneys are exceptionally good at moderating and modulating how much water is coming and going based on where your plasma levels are and things like that. And so it's probably not really true that by the time you feel thirsty, you're dehydrated. That's probably not really true. But it is true that you need water to survive, and it's a good thing. So, I try and get – I'm always got water around, and I'm drinking it. And, you know, I don't know. I might make those eight glasses sometimes. I'm probably always in the kind of – 5 to 6 range, you know.
So. Okay. How much of that is, we talk about moisture in our foods, and I don't know if it's a fallacy or if it's real, but if I ate a meatloaf, there's moisture in the meatloaf, right?
Sure.
So that's part of...
Yeah, I mean, that's part of, there's animals that never drink. They just get it out of their food, and probably 30 or 40% of what we end up getting every day is just in the food we eat. So.
Okay, I know you're not a fan of energy drinks. I have a relative of mine that swears by them, drinks one or two a day, and I don't know if that's a good idea, but... I'm not talking about like Gatorade. I'm talking about the Monster type, or Red Bull or whatever, the big time energy ones.
The caffeine content is just astronomical, right? And so, and I think we've probably talked about this, but caffeine, the most universally used stimulant on the planet, it interferes with sleep. You know, if it's on board, it has this nasty tachyphylactic cycle. So tachyphylaxis is where you grow accustomed to it over time, and
You need more.
And so you need more and more and more to try and get the same effect. And in fact, you end up not able to maintain your baseline level of alertness and awareness, even if you are drinking caffeine. It's just, it's a nasty, nasty cycle. And so, that's what's addictive about it is, I'm dragging, I need something to pick me up, and you wouldn't have needed that if you didn't have it. The other thing that happens is it doesn't work for you the way you need it to when you really need it to, right? So, if you're on the road, traveling, and you need that pick up and you drink caffeine, it's really not going to get you where you need to go, where if you weren't, it probably would. So I think infrequent use of caffeine is helpful for those kinds of situations. You're a little tired and you don't want to be alert while you're driving, kind of thing. But taking it all the time is a recipe for making it not work at all for you. Wow. In fact, making your overall level of awareness and all that not as good as it needs to be. So
you kind of already answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. In college, I had a big test the next morning. I needed to study late into the night and maybe an all-nighter or whatever. I took Vivarin. Remember Vivarin?
Yeah.
But because I didn't consume much caffeine, maybe not any back then, that probably helped me.
It probably made you more alert than you would have been. But ultimately, the biggest problem you were doing was not sleeping. So
yeah, that's true.
So when you don't get REM sleep, you can't process that information and make it accessible to you the next day.
So cramming all night was not a good idea.
You're not helping your score or anything else. You probably end up just doing worse as a result of not sleeping. And so, and that caffeine probably was such a big dose, it probably got you through the next day, but as soon as it wore off, you were in trouble.
Yeah. Right? And so they still sell that Vivarin, I imagine, right?
I'd imagine they do, yeah. There's plenty of ways to get caffeine out there.
Probably college bookstores. You can buy a Monster and a Vivarin, and for the next 12 hours, your eyes are wide open, and the next 12 hours after that, crash.
Some of those energy drinks have 300-350 milligrams of caffeine in it. You know,
give us a comparison. So a cup of coffee is
About 45.
Oh, so it's almost 10 times that.
Soda somewhere in the 30 to 40 range, you know.
Wow.
25 to 30 depending on the soda.
Is there long-term harm to drinking those types of those Monster drinks?
There's the harm that comes from you just aren't able to keep yourself awake, you know, without them.
Yeah.
And caffeine, it turns out, is a natural diuretic. So, you know, we talked about keeping hydrated and stuff like that. So there actually are kids that die every year from parents will stoke them up on a Red Bull or something, send them out to run around the soccer field and they're dehydrated and they collapse, you know, on the soccer field. So, in kids, certainly a very bad idea, but for all of us, I think there are consequences for continually stimulating your nervous system and your sympathetic, keeping yourself on edge, you know, anxiety and whatever kinds of things. So.
All right. He's Dr. Blodgett. We got to get a commercial break in, back with more. We'll talk vaccines a little bit when we come back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Hey, welcome back. 9:48 on KDXU. It's Dr. Blodgett here, from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. He's in charge of five counties, right?
Yeah, there's five counties in our district, too.
So let me see if I can name Beaver, Kane, Iron, Washington, and Garfield?
Garfield County. Yeah, okay. That's right. Got about 300,000 population now.
Most of it, about two-thirds of all that, is in this one county that we're in right
county.
Now.
We're adding as many people to this county as are in some of those counties.
Every month.
All the time.
Yeah,
so,
that's crazy. All right, let's talk. And you know, it's interesting. I think about your job, Dr. Blodgett. And I know that you're aware that if you say anything, people are going to say, oh, there's a doctor nagging again about sleeping or eating right or exercise. Here it comes. And so, I'm obviously you're cognizant of that, and I'm cognizant of. We go on the radio and we talk about it. It might sound like nagging, but let's. With that risk there, I still think we should talk about vaccinations. I know people, and unfortunately that population is growing, people that say, I will never vaccinate my kids for all these diseases that we had all but eradicated because it's going to cause whatever, autism or whatever. And that was made worse by what happened with COVID and, you know, a lot of people feeling the COVID shots were ineffective. And so they go, okay, if that's not going to work, none of them work. So, and they just rule them out. And so you're having to deal with the fallout now.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to unpack there.
I know. And we have 9 minutes, but
first, were the COVID shots effective? Did people overpromise because they didn't know what they were talking about? Absolutely, right? Yes. On the media and stuff like that. Right. But we've always known that the purpose of vaccination is to decrease the severity, right? For some people, and a lot of people, if you decrease the severity, that makes it much less likely to die. And all.
But other people, a lot of people believe the purpose of vaccination is to completely, so you won't get it.
And there are a certain amount of people that will just never get it again because they've been vaccinated. There are some that are immune compromised or just not having, they just can't quite get that immunity up. But it allows them to deal with it in a more productive way. If you remember, a lot of the problem with COVID and a new strain of the flu or a lot of other new drugs is because your body's never seen it before, it's a freakout factor, right? It over-responds.
Right,
it's that over-response that creates a lot of trouble for the body and everything else. And so being exposed to it helps your body figure out how to process and not do that over response. And so, flu shots, are they going to keep you from getting the flu? In some people, in a lot of people, it'll just be a lot milder than it would have been otherwise. Right?
Milder,
and that's a good outcome, right? That's what you're looking for. And so the COVID didn't work is not true, but have they overplayed their hand in saying everybody should get boosters for every minute of the day? Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, I think if you've gotten one or two shots and had the disease, then that's about as good as it's going to get, you know.
Especially if you're relatively young and healthy.
Yes, absolutely.
Under 65, over 3 years old.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in that over 65 group, particularly if you're in the over 80 group, then a yearly booster makes sense, right? But for the vast majority of us, it just doesn't. And I think people intuitively know. I think people intuitively knew a lot of things about COVID. They just weren't what the media was trying to sell or the political agenda or whatever it was. And we talked about that a lot on this show. And unfortunately, public health's taken the lumps on this, and it wasn't really public health. It was a political agenda and stuff like that, you know. So, but that's another discussion for another time. The problem with not vaccinating is so we choose to create vaccines for the diseases that are the most deadly, right?
The worst.
And so you're exposed to hundreds of various bugs every day, and your body fights them off. It's not that big a deal. There are some diseases, though, that the race between your body trying to fight it off and the bug winning and killing you, it tilts towards the bug more often than not, right? So so you take a disease like diphtheria, you know, that kills 10 or 15% of the kids that get it. Or, smallpox used to kill a third of the people that got it. One out of three. I mean, in our world, it's hard to comprehend what that kind of a disease looks like, you know. And it no longer exists on the planet because we were able to vaccinate for it and it's gone, right? And so, polio, which paralyzed kids, or you see the, you know, kids in the iron lungs, which is how they used to deal with them back then. And we don't have respirators now, but those things terrified mothers. And, you know, 5,000 kids a year used to die from measles in this country. And, you know, we call it a mild childhood illness, but that's, there's no way COVID killed even a fraction of that.
Right.
And yet we set our society down for it, right? And so, so what we're talking about is whether or not we see these diseases circulating again in our population. And so it's really easy to be anti-vaccine and say, oh, you know, vaccines don't do anything, because we've largely gotten rid of those diseases because of vaccination, high vaccination rates. As those rates drop and we don't have the critical mass to keep them away, then you start to see them circulating again. You'll start to see kids dying from diseases they just don't need to die from, and significant sequelae from everybody, you know, diphtheria, typhoid, all of those diseases are tetanus. Are you kidding me? You know what tetanus does to people? And
I don't think I want to know.
You're not going to vaccinate for tetanus anymore, so it's called lockjaw.
Lockjaw.
Every muscle in your body cramps up and you can't move, and so you no longer can breathe or anything, and you die a terrible, miserable death, and it doesn't need to happen. But tetanus is in the soil. It's everywhere, right? So you're going to get exposed to it, and you don't vaccinate for it, that's a problem, right? And so... Yeah. These things swing, right? I get calls from people that their kids have had pertussis, and they're like, this is a terrible disease, you know, we need to do something about it. And we say, yeah, it's called vaccination, right? and so they call it the 100-day cough for a reason, and those kids will take 3-4 courses of antibiotics, and they still won't be better, and they're out of school that whole time, you know. I mean, there are consequences for ignoring what is a real benefit to society in general and to the individual of not having to deal with these diseases that are terrible.
So I had someone say, hey, what do I care if this guy chooses not to vaccinate his kids because I vaccinated mine so they won't ever get it. What should be the concern for those that do vaccinate for those that don't?
So there is a distributive justice argument here that this is what the Supreme Court uses to uphold vaccine mandates and stuff like that in school, is there are a certain number in the population, probably about 10%, that their immune system is insufficient to take advantage of the vaccines. So for these kids, when you get vaccinated so you don't get the disease, you are protecting them too with that concept of herd immunity. And so, so when you don't get vaccinated and you expose them, then they die because they were vaccinated, but it didn't work.
Didn't work for them. Okay.
That's the argument, on why school immunizations are there. But a lot of people are not doing that.
So. Do we know a number of that where they don't work on? Is it a very small number?
It's somewhere in the 5 to 10% range.
Okay, so it's significant.
It's a significant chunk of the population, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So if you don't, if you're not sure about the vaccination, it sounds like a pretty good reason there.
Yeah, so anybody that has an immune suppression going on, too, is in that boat. So, you know, cancer. People that have cancer and they're getting cancer therapy, or there's just a lot of immune compromised situations where we're getting good at helping those people live longer, but you know, they get a disease like measles or pertussis or diphtheria or something, that's going to be a real problem for them.
Trouble. Okay. So. All right. He's Dr. David Blodgett. We got about a minute and a half left. Is there anything on your calendar that you were supposed to bring up? Dave Heaton is going to say, hey, you guys didn't talk about this, that, the other. I know you guys were really pushing hard on the A1C test and trying to get people who are pre-diabetic to understand that it's not too late to do something about it.
We had a free month again this last month, and nobody took us up on it because nobody wants to know.
But you do want to know
because if you can stop progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes, your life is just so much better. You know, losing 5 to 7% of your body weight, you know, back to our Ozempic discussion, decreases the progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes by 68%, right? I mean, we're not talking a huge amount of lifestyle change, but some, or, you know, maybe getting on metformin or something, you know, where you know that you're at risk. So the conversion rate from pre-diabetes to diabetes is like 10 or 15% a year, right? So over a 10-year period, almost 100% of those people will end up with diabetes. And it's terrifying from a standpoint of cost to society and cost to the individual of, you know, it puts a cramp in your style. You know, it just becomes it becomes your life is trying to deal with this disease that has so many drastic consequences.
It is not free, but you still can get a very cheap A1C test at the health department right now if you want one.
Yeah, head on 20, down. $35 I think is all they are.
$35
A lot cheaper than the hospital or anything like that.
He's Dr. Blodgett here every first Wednesday of the month. Thank you, Doc, for coming. Appreciate you.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.